Amen. Very good. This is emor, which is the Hebrew word for speak. But as you can see, these are words spoken unto the priests. The portion is Leviticus chapters 21 through 24. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, a priest must not make himself ceremonially unclean for any of his people who die, except for a close relative." And the close relatives are identified here, such as his mother, his father, his son, daughter, or brother. Okay? And of course, it would include a sister who is not unmarried. Okay? Now, we're going to talk about this in a few minutes, but I suppose you notice that the priest's wife is not mentioned here, but it certainly applies to her. And we'll talk about that in a minute, right? So, the close relatives would be a wife, mother, father, son, daughter, brother, and unmarried sister. Okay? He must not make himself unclean for people related to him by marriage, and so defile himself. So, these are the only ones that the priest can become ceremonially unclean on the behalf of. So, it obviously is a reference to occasions or the times when someone passes away. Typically, a Kohen, a priest, does not attend funeral services because of this instruction. The only services that they can attend are for close relatives, right? But not for friends, not for relatives by marriage, and so they typically, even today, do not attend funeral services for those who are not close relatives. So we'll begin with Emor el HaKohanim, the say to the Kohen, the principles of holiness as experienced by the Jewish nation are developed in three major stages. We talked about threes last week. Here's another example. From the broad base of the nation up to the level of the Levites, and then to the highest level, the Kohanim, with Kohen Gadol, with the high priest, at the very summit of human holiness, or at least that is the way it's supposed to work. Having specified the duties of holiness for the first two stages, the Torah now addresses itself to the priests. This concept of a gradual progression in the level of holiness is consistent with Jewish philosophy and matches the Kabbalistic concept of God's holiness radiating outward through successive spheres or concentric circles. Just as the reality of holiness progresses through society and its stages, so does it pass through the dimensions of space and time. We find another example of the progression of holiness in the ascending levels of sanctity, going from the land of Israel to Jerusalem, to the temple, and then to the Holy of Holies, right? So there is various levels of holiness with regard to these things as well, these places. The same principle occurs in the unfolding of time from ordinary weekdays up to its summit of holiness on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is regarded as the holiest of our holidays. Thus we see that the structures of society reflect the image of nature as expressed in space and time. This offers us an understanding of existence as a vast hierarchy, a complex yet essentially clear and harmonious structure, which serves as a model for the organization of society. There are a couple of passages here which speak of the sanctity of the Messiah in his role as our high priest. He's even referred to as our great high priest in Hebrews chapter 4, who ascended into heaven, right? And it speaks of the fact that he was tempted like us, but did not sin, which is a characteristic of the holiness of the priest. In Hebrews 9, it speaks of the fact that the Messiah did not enter the sanctuary made with human hands, right? He did not enter the sanctuary of the earthly tabernacle. He entered the sanctuary of the heavenly tabernacle. That's where he appeared as a sacrifice for sin, to do away with sin by the sacrifice of himself. Right? So, this is an important idea as well. We've mentioned this before, but why could not Yeshua enter the Holy of Holies of the earthly tabernacle? Because he was not a Levite. Right? He was not a priest. He was not a priest after the order of Aaron. He could not have been the high priest of the earthly tabernacle. He could not have served as one of the priests of the earthly tabernacle, right? He would not even have been qualified to sing in the choir that provided the musical accompaniment to the services during the services at the tabernacle itself. He would have been in the court of Israel with the majority of other Israelites, right? But he is a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, and so all of the things which are spoken of regarding our earthly high priest are also spoken of regarding him. It's just that he serves in a different place, a different sanctuary. With regard to the holiness of places, notice that Jerusalem is referred to as the holy city in Nehemiah 11. Jerusalem is also referred to as the holy city in Matthew 4, when the devil took him to the holy city and have him stand on the highest point of the temple. Matthew doesn't identify Jerusalem as the holy city, but it is the place where the temple was, and every reader of Matthew, at least in the first century when it was composed, would have recognized this reference to Jerusalem. And notice in Revelation 21, in the passage which speaks of a new heaven and a new earth, John says, "I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, right, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband." And of course, the word holy land, the expression, is found in the book of Zechariah. So the land of Israel, the land chosen by God as a gift for Abraham and his descendants, is referred to as a holy land. Okay, number two. Ve'amarta aleihem, and tell them, the unusual structure, ve'amartem, from the root amor, say and tell, may be explained as follows. Tell the Kohanim individually to speak to their children. The Kohanim were to watch over the holiness of the family by putting each of their children on guard against spiritual contamination. This is an interesting application of the passage, but it does speak to several specific instances in the scriptures where not only in the case of priests, like with Eli, for example, who was, was probably a great priest, but not a particularly good father, and did not really raise his sons to walk in his ways. That's how we come to know Samuel, the prophet. We see in the Torah that Moses' sons don't really figure into any ongoing ministry that he is a part of. David, of course, had a great deal of difficulty with his children. The scripture specifically says of David that he never disciplined them, right? He never questioned anything they did. And so here we have an instruction that's understood by Rashi, by the Sifra, by Mizrahi as being an instruction regarding the responsibility that priests have to instruct their children in you know, the things that they should do. And of course, their children as priests will ultimately grow up to become priests themselves. Right? That's the way it works. At any rate, Rambam refers to the statement in the Talmud that the adult Kohanim, the adult priests, had a duty not to contaminate their own youngsters, yet also had to teach them to avoid contamination, right? So on the occasion when they were contaminated, they had a responsibility to make sure that that none of their family members were contaminated. And they had a responsibility to teach them regarding contamination. This obligation rested upon the Kohanim themselves and not upon the religious authorities. Rambam points out that the same principle of obliging the parents not to desecrate their youngsters with what is forbidden to adults applies to all prohibitions in the Torah. And so this is an important instruction as well that applies generally to us all regarding the raising of our children. Despite this Talmudic interpretation, many commentators draw other lessons from the threefold repetition of the word emor. In this verse, according to Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the natural kindness and sense of duty of the Kohanim might lead them to go overboard in expressing their respect for the dead, going so far as to shave their heads and notice and cutting themselves in mourning. That is why there was a need for extra emphasis here to discourage them from such practices. Of course, it is impossible to read this passage without thinking of the parable of the Good Samaritan in Luke chapter 10, which we have discussed before, but you're familiar with the story about an individual who was robbed and harmed and beaten up and left for dead on the side of a road, and a priest came by, and rather than getting involved with the individual, he crosses to the other side of the road. The Levite does the same thing, right? But what's important to appreciate is that both of them were under strict law not to allow themselves to be contaminated for a non-relative, right? Which this individual lying on the side of the road was, right? They were both Sadducees. The reason why they crossed to the other side of the road is not because they didn't have compassion on the individual who was lying there, but they were either on their way to the temple to perform their responsibilities as a priest or a Levite generally, or they were on their way home, right, from their semi-annual circuit or course or obligated service in the temple. But in either case, they can't be contaminated, right? If they're on their way to Jerusalem, they wouldn't be allowed to serve, and if they're on their way home, they might contaminate their families, right? So in both cases, what they did was the right thing to do based upon what the Torah says, right? The difference, of course, is that Yeshua was not a Sadducee. He was a Pharisee, right? And for Pharisees, the ability to affect good in a person's life takes precedence over some of these other instructions, right? Not for Sadducees, but for Pharisees, right? So, if the parable had mentioned a Pharisee stopping by to assist this individual, nobody would have been surprised. If Yeshua would have mentioned one of his disciples stopping to assist this individual, nobody would have been surprised, right? And frankly, he would have made the same point, but not as powerfully as using the example of a Samaritan, because the Samaritan was regarded as an enemy of the Jewish people, right? But at least he stopped and rendered aid, the aid that was required, right? A Pharisee would have rendered the aid, a disciple of Yeshua would have rendered the aid, and in this particular case, a Samaritan would have rendered the aid. So, of course, the whole question comes up regarding, well, who is my neighbor, right? The one who renders aid. The neighbor, by the way, is not the individual who is harmed. The aid, the one who renders aid, is the neighbor. And because we are all created in God's image, we are all neighbors, and we all have a responsibility to, you know, to work for the good on the behalf of others. It's a beautiful, beautiful story. And it helps us to appreciate Yeshua's perspective regarding the Torah, that there are some things that take precedence over specific instructions in the Torah, and saving a life is one of them, right? And of course, if you're familiar with the rabbinic literature, you see this in rabbinic writings generally, right? It's okay to violate an instruction in the Torah in order to save a life. The other comment which is important here has to do with their inability to cut themselves in mourning. It is sometimes said, as we will read in the following verse in Leviticus 19, here's a specific instruction of it: do not cut your bodies for the dead or put tattoo marks on yourselves, I am the Lord. I'm not sure where the word tattoo comes from in this translation, but it is not what the text says. Okay? Now, I'm not a big fan of covering your bodies with tattoos. Don't get me wrong, but tattoos have nothing to do with what is actually prohibited here. Look at the way the Tanakh translates it, and this translation makes more sense in terms of Monk's comment in the last paragraph of the passage we just read, right? Where he says, according to Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the natural kindness and sense of duty of the Kohanim might lead them to go overboard in expressing their respect for the dead, going so far as to shave their heads and cutting themselves in mourning, right? Cutting themselves in mourning, which is how the Tanakh translates it, and the Targum Jonathan, Pseudo-Jonathan, translates it too. You shall not make gashes in your flesh for the dead, or incise any marks on yourself. I am the Lord. The word gash and the word incise speak of making marks in your flesh with a knife, right? Slicing your arms with a knife as a way of expressing grief. The Targum Jonathan says, and a corrupting incision. Notice, for the soul of the dead you shall not make in your flesh. Neither set up yourselves an inscription. In other words, you can't cut an inscription into your flesh, either with a knife or any figurative sign, I am the Lord. In other words, it is possible, of course, to make, you know, to draw a symbol on your flesh, but with a knife, in a way that the skin is cut. And so when the skin heals, and the gash marks heal, right, the skin scars, and the symbol, whatever it was that was etched into the skin, survives because, right, it's a scar. Gashes in your flesh for the dead. Judaism teaches us to express this grief by tearing our garments. Notice, rather than by wounding ourselves. which is what was done among the pagans in biblical times. Again, we are taught that the quest for holiness includes respect for one's body rather than a concentration on the spiritual at the body's expense. Okay? One final comment about this. You shall not make cuts in your flesh for a person who died. And according to Rashi, this was the practice of the Amorites. Right? So it's a idolatrous practice. It expresses a grief that knows no limits or bounds. And that kind of grief, we're prohibited from, the Jewish people are prohibited from a grief that is that, that great. At any rate, to make cuts in their flesh when a person related to them died. Moving on, the Zohar recalls that the verb emor implies speaking with softness. The verb is repeated three times here because it is the tone most appropriate for Kohanim, whose service was to be performed in reverential silence. I'm not sure why the term reverential is applied to the word silence. Sometimes silence can be reverential, but joy can be reverential as well, right? An expression of joy and excitement can be reverential as well. At any rate, the sacred place where their duties are performed reflects the highest degree of spiritual purity. This is a place in which the silence of absolute holiness reigns. And of course, when Aaron went into the holy place and into the Holy of Holies, he was by himself. He had a cord tied around his right ankle in case he didn't do something properly or apply the blood of the sacrifice onto the atonement cover properly, or if his attitude or heart were not in the right place, like with Nadav and Avihu, right? He had this cord tied around his ankle so that if anything happened to him, nobody had to go in and get him, right? They would drag him out, right? It was a very sacred duty he undertook when he was in the temple. And of course, I would guess that he did not talk to himself. He was probably very quiet, and the place itself was very quiet. But the sages in the Midrash draw another lesson from the repetition of the verb emor. They see it as underscoring the importance that the Torah attaches to transmitting the laws from father to son. Another emphasis on this: the safeguarding of this principle is incumbent upon all generations of Kohanim and is not dependent on the presence of the temple in Jerusalem. Indeed, the preservation of spiritual purity is the unique and personal contribution of the Kohanim. It confers upon them a permanent dignity and nobility, independent of their hereditary entitlement to practice the priesthood and to perform the sacrificial services, right? And so, this idea regarding passing instruction from father to son is an important one in Jewish thought, but it doesn't just involve sons. As we'll see from these two passages, it involves daughters too, right? In other words, passing words of Torah to our children is an important idea. I love this first story from the tractate on the woman suspected of adultery. A certain widow had a synagogue in her neighborhood, yet she used to come daily to the school of Rabbi Yochanan and pray there. He said to her, "My daughter, is there not a synagogue in your neighborhood?" And she answered, "Yes, Rabbi, but I have not the reward for my steps." Right? In other words, there is a synagogue in my neighborhood, but I don't get the same things from the teaching there that I get from the teaching here, right? So That's the reason why she walked the extra distance to Rabbi Yochanan's synagogue, or to his service. And this passage from Avot, Ben Azai says, run to perform even a minor mitzvah, a commandment, and flee from sin, for one mitzvah leads to another mitzvah, and one sin leads to another sin. For the consequence of a mitzvah is a mitzvah, and the consequence of a sin is a sin. This rabbi, Shimon ben Azai, was a second century Tana, one of the teachers involved in the Mishnah. He is among those who visited the orchard. There is a story associated with this. If you were in our Perkei Avot study, you're familiar with it. He is the one who died. There were four rabbis who enter the orchard. At any rate, by the way, the word in Hebrew for orchard is pardes. That's where the word comes from. He taught that one was obligated to teach one's daughter Torah as well as one's son. Okay? So let's move on. No one may contaminate himself. Tradition explains spiritual contamination as coming about through contact with a dead body, either directly or indirectly. The body deprived of a soul is a source of contamination. Death is the ultimate expression of the stripping of the soul and spirit from matter. Notice that Monk does not use the word body, right? He uses the word matter, although, of course, Monk is familiar with the word body, and there is a word for body in modern Hebrew, but there was not in biblical times. Death is the ultimate expression of stripping of the soul and spirit from matter. Thus, the dead body represents physical nature in its most absolute form and is the negation of the moral freedom that life offers to us. Interesting perspective. Number four, except for the relative who is closest to him, the word ki'im lish'aro, the word she'aro, means his flesh and refers to none other than his wife, right? So the reason why the wife is not identified among the close relatives in the passage we read earlier is because a wife is regarded as sharing the flesh of her husband, and so of course it includes her. It was shown in the commentary to chapter 20, verse 10, that kinships established through marriage are in no way inferior to those based upon bloodlines. Right, so. An individual's wife is as important to him as his mother, his father, his brother, his sister, his son or daughter. However, Rashi does point out that this law does not apply to someone whom the Kohen married in violation of the Torah. Okay. A couple of the passages that speak to this. One is in Genesis 2. Hold on here. Let me let Susanna in. Hopefully she wasn't waiting long. Very good. Genesis chapter 2, where the Lord causes Adam to fall into a deep sleep. He takes one of his ribs, and then closes up the place with flesh. The Lord God made a woman from the rib he had taken out of the man, and he brought her to the man. But the man says, notice in verse 23, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. And she is called woman because she was taken out of man. And this is why a man leaves his father and his mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh, right? Because they become, right, a couple, an individual unit, similar to that of their father and their mother, but they become a father and a mother as well, right? Or at least they have the status of a father and a mother, a couple that they are, right? They're bound together in marriage and bound together in a way that is reflected in this passage in Ephesians 5, when Paul, writing about the work of the Messiah on our behalf, speaks to husband and tells them to love their wives just as the Messiah loved the Messianic community, indeed gave himself up on its behalf, right? If you look in verse 28, this is how husbands ought to love their wives like their own bodies. For the man who loves his wife is loving himself. Right? So in the Bible there is a connection that exists between husbands and wives, which is reflected in this passage regarding those that a priest can be contaminated on the behalf of. The rabbis explain this instruction to include a sister who is betrothed, right, but not one who is married. Even though betrothal and marriage in the Bible are very similar, they're still a little different, and one of the differences is that they have not yet consummated the marriage on the evening of the wedding, right? On her marriage, a woman becomes a part of her husband, and a husband becomes a part of his wife, right? It works the same way in both directions. At any rate, if you look at the next page, the wife is not mentioned in this passage, as she is not mentioned in several other passages throughout the Torah, because a man and his wife are regarded as basar echad, as one flesh. Okay? And notice that both Abraham and Jacob personally attended to their wives' burials. So, they were obviously not priests, but they were so connected to their wives that they attended to their burials. Moving on to chapter 21, verse 6. They, the priests, must be holy to their God and must not profane the name of their God because they present the food offerings to the Lord. Notice the food of their God. They are to be holy. This is an awkward expression in Hebrew. We'll talk about it in a second. Let me talk for a minute about the expression Kedoshim Yehiyu, they shall be holy. This is an interesting section. This is an imperative. And notice Monk's comment, which I put in italics and made bold and even put in red, even against their will, according to Rashi. The court will oblige them to remain holy, despite the fact that the holiness of the Kohanim is a privilege of birth granted by God. I am Hashem, Hashem who sanctifies you. The hereditary honor remains in effect, even when the Kohen has been declared unfit for the sacrificial service because of a mum, a physical defect. However, the Kohen does forfeit his right upon entering into an illicit marriage, according to Orech Chaim. There's a footnote. It's a work, the manner of life or the way of life. At any rate, these general provisions pertaining to the status of the Kohanim, notice, apply in a similar fashion to the Jewish people as a nation. Indeed, from its very beginning, the Jewish people was designated Mamlechet Kohanim, a kingdom of Kohanim. No more than the Kohen, the Jew cannot back out of his natural calling. He can, of course, turn his back on Judaism, but he remains Jewish nonetheless. And this is an important statement. Alf Alpi Shechata Yisrael Hu. Even though he may have sinned, he is a Jew. Right? So a Jew is considered a Jew, regardless of anything he has done. The return to faithfulness to God and his law will always remain the first duty stemming from his duty as a Jew. We talked about this a few weeks earlier when we talked about circumcision, right? The fact that, it would be one thing if the instruction to be circumcised, if it was mentioned, that when a child becomes an adult, when a young man becomes an adult, then he should be circumcised, right? That would make some sense. But that isn't what's said. When a child is 8 days old, he's supposed to be circumcised, right? I mean, an 8-day-old child has absolutely nothing to do with the procedure, right? He doesn't give his assent or agreement to it. I mean, he's held down and the procedure is undertaken, right? It's way better at 8 days old than it would have been at 13 years old. But the point is that the child has no say in the matter. He's connected to the covenant that God made with Abraham and his descendants, right? And it's interesting because the same thing is mentioned of the priest. That the priest, they need to be holy, right? And this is something that they don't really have a choice in, right? The priests were the descendants of Aaron. The whole tribe of Levi was set apart in a way which was different than the way the other tribes were set apart, and they had different responsibilities in the temple, right? Or in the tabernacle prior to the construction of the temple. They played different roles, but each role involved the temple, and they had to be holy in order to serve the Lord in their in their capacity as a Levite, or in their capacity as a priest, or as a high priest, right? What's interesting is that the same idea applies to the Jewish people generally, and is communicated in this passage in Deuteronomy 29. All of you are standing today in the presence of the Lord your God, your leaders and your chief men, your elders and officials, and all the other men of Israel, together with your children and your wives. And notice, and the foreigners living in your camps, right? Because a mixed multitude left Egypt. So this instruction in Deuteronomy 29 applies to the leaders, to the chief men, to the elders and the officials of God's people, to all the other men of Israel, the children, the women, and the strangers, right? In verse 12, you are standing here in order to enter into a covenant with the Lord your God. But what's important about it is what he goes on to say in verse 14. I am making this covenant with its oath, not only with you who are standing here with us today in the presence of the Lord our God, but also with those who are not here today. Right? So, I happen to be there when God made his covenant with his people on Mount Sinai. I was there. I mean, you ask, how could you possibly have been there? Right? You might be old, but you're not that old. Right? But the point is, I was in the loins of my ancestor Levi. When Levi stood there before the Lord, or his descendants stood there before the Lord, then I was there too. At least that's what the passage speaks of, because I was in my ancestors when this covenant was made with them. And so it was made with me as well. They said on my behalf and on their own behalf, everything that the Lord has said, we will do and understand, right? We'll do. We embrace what God has called us to do as a people. I was a part of the people at that point, right? But maybe some of your relatives were there as well, because there were non-Jews in that company too, right? The covenant was made with them as well. This next section speaks of the concept of holiness, and I don't want to go over this except just to mention that the concept of holiness or sanctity or sanctification has to do with places, times, persons and things, people. It also speaks of God. And you can look these passages up. There are many, many passages in the Bible that speak of places being holy, times being holy, people being holy, things being holy, and God being holy. And then the note at the bottom, the term sanctification and holiness do not refer to moral or spiritual qualities, and this is incredibly important, but rather to position and relationship. It's about one's position vis-a-vis his relationship with God, right? It's about one's relationship with God. The terms sanctification and holiness are involved being set apart by God, being connected to God, being connected to the same spiritual dimension that God is connected to. The word kadosh reflects the position that some person or thing has in relationship to God, consecrated, set apart to his work and purpose. Therefore, any moral or spiritual connotation is a result and not a cause of relationship with God. Okay? Very, very important idea. By the way, that's why it's so important when we speak of the idea of being in the Messiah. Right? You're familiar with that expression? It's used a few times in the apostolic writings. We are spoken of as being in the Messiah. By the way, the Messiah was in the loins of his ancestors standing at Mount Sinai too. So, if you think about it, if you are in the Messiah, then you were in the loins of the Messiah's ancestors as they stood before the Lord at Mount Sinai too. Right? Let's move on to the next item. The food of their God, I mentioned, was an awkward expression. Literally, it's the bread of their God. That is the substance of their offering to God, which is the way it would probably have best been translated. The priests need to be holy to the Lord because they present the food offerings to the Lord, right? The substance of their offering to God. It's a parallelism. It's a way of expressing the same idea twice, that the food offering to the Lord, the bread offering, the grain offering to the Lord, is not the food that God eats, which is the way the passage makes it sound, but it's the substance of the offering that they offer to the Lord. The Hebrew lechem, the Hebrew word for bread, like in Beit Lechem, the house of bread, Bethlehem, the Hebrew word lechem has here its principal Semitic meaning, flesh. Ironically, in Hebrew, the word lechem, which is translated bread in most places, means flesh, meat, substance, right? Another indication that the Hebrew associated with the sacrificial system is quite old. The grain offering on the top of the next page, the Hebrew mincha, originally a gift of any kind, is called a meat offering, right? That's what it was called originally, and that is the way you might find it translated in translations like the King James. In some translations, it's used in the Old English sense of meat, that is food. It is sometimes called a meal offering or a cereal offering because it consisted of flour or baked goods. The sacrifices are referred to as lechem because they are offered to God in the same way as food is served to humans. Right? So this is another example of Hebrew describing things the way they look, not the way they are. Because God obviously doesn't eat the things that are offered to him. In most ancient societies, it was believed that gods required sustenance. That is not what the Jews believed. And in other ancient societies, right, the gods relied on sacrifices for energy and strength. But of course, that is not true of God. He does not rely upon us for energy and strength. But this is characteristic of, I'm not sure I want to use the word all, but I can certainly use the word most ancient societies where, and by the way, those that still exist today, where food is offered to gods, right? Which brings us to an important passage in the Gospel of John. When Yeshua says that I am the bread of life, he's making an important statement here. Your ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness, yet they died. But here is the bread that comes down from heaven, which anyone may eat and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. Now, is Yeshua actually talking about the fact that we are supposed to chop him up and eat him like a good ribeye at the end of the day? No, of course not, right? He is using the word bread, frankly, in the same way it's used in this passage in Leviticus 21, in the sense of sustenance, right? In other words, I am the sustenance of life. I am the one who sustains life, right? I'm the one that you have to be connected to in order to experience life in the Olam Haba. Because in verse 52, notice that the Judeans begin to argue sharply among themselves, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? Right? I mean, as you can imagine, it was an unusual way of expressing an idea in Hebrew. Frankly, Yeshua could have said this very differently. Why doesn't he? It's a very provocative statement, right? And because he knew the hearts of those he was talking to, he had to say something that would capture their attention, right? He had to say it in such a way so that everyone would get a bit of a whiplash when they heard him utter these words, like, what? Right? That's why he sometimes speaks like this. And by the way, that is also sometimes why there are such dramatic elements in the parables, like the Samaritan, for example, right? That's why those characters exist in parables, because Yeshua wants to, you know, wants his audience to pay attention to what it is that he is saying. And frankly, he wants them to pay attention to the significance of what he's saying, beyond the words, right? Yeshua said to them, very truly I tell you, he repeats it, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you, right? So instead of explaining what he means, he just repeats it. Why? Because he wants those with a heart to hear it, to hear it. And those who don't, not to. That was one of the ways that that God communicates concepts and ideas to his people. Okay? But notice in verse 54, whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. Of course, this idea involves the concept, or the idea which we'll talk about in a minute, that offering a sacrifice to God means participating in the sacrifice, right? Kind of being connected to the sacrifice in some ways, so that you are actually being offered to the Lord as well, right? So that's one of the things that Yeshua is alluding to. But many of those in his audience obviously missed the point, as did the early church fathers, by the way. This verse is a midrash connected to verses like the passage in Leviticus 21, verse 6, that speak of the bread, and another passage that speak of the blood offered to the Lord, right? And these are passages that Paul has in mind when he writes to the Corinthians. Don't you know that those who serve in the temple get their food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share in what is offered on the altar? Right? In other words, there is a connection between the sacrifice and the offerer, which Yeshua is alluding to. And of course, it speaks of Yeshua's connection to us as well, right? That God made him who had no sin to be sin for us. So he is connected to us, and we are connected to him, and that's what Yeshua is referring to in this passage, right? That unless we are connected to him, unless we are in him, unless there is some, unless something occurs in our lives which connects us to him, we will not have access to the Olam Haba. And that, of course, was or is, both tenses are correct, the role of the Messiah in the lives of people in biblical times and in the lives of people today, right? The earthly priesthood facilitated a relationship with God in this Olam Hazeh, in this world, and the Messiah facilitates relationship with God not only in this world but in the world to come as well. Okay? I wasn't sure how much of the rest of it we would get to, but that's okay. Let me just take a minute and explain a couple of things. This next section speaks of the fact that priests were not allowed to marry women defiled by prostitution, but this refers to someone, to a woman. By the way, it could apply to a man as well. It applies to a woman who is habitually given to harlotry, not just to one who may have lapsed on a particular occasion. And then this next section speaks of the way the high priest had to take care of himself, right? He could not let his hair become unkempt. He could not tear his clothes because he was dedicated by the anointing oil of his God. So the next section speaks of the way the high priest had to present himself when he served the Lord in the presence of the people, right? And that presentation was important. And of course, as a priest aged, or if he were to be in an accident and be disfigured, then of course he could not function as a priest. He would not be allowed to serve in that role, which reminds me of that passage in Romans where Paul says of us that we should live our lives as a living sacrifice, right? That's the way priests who were either injured or as they got older, a priest when they reached the age of 50, for example, they had to retire. They probably no longer had the physical strength required to serve the Lord in that regard. But when priests did get that old, they became mentors to younger priests and helped train them in their obligation and responsibility to serve the Lord. But in any case, they were still dedicated to God and still had to be holy, right? So that is true of us as well. When we dedicate our lives to the Lord, right, when something happens that compromises the way we can serve God, right, we can never lose sense of that, process, that dedication, that we belong to the Lord, not to ourselves any longer, right? Once something has been dedicated to the Lord, like an animal that is supposed to be sacrificed, right? If an animal that is supposed to be sacrificed is injured on the way to the altar, if it has a blemish of any kind or acquires a blemish of any kind, it cannot be sacrificed. But because it's been dedicated to the Lord, it cannot return to a normal life either. It lives out the rest of its life as a member of God's flock, right? As a member of the temple flock. The flocks assigned to the temple were shepherded, by the way, in the fields outside of Bethlehem, right? But they were special flocks and could not go or live anywhere else. They were under the strict supervision of the temple shepherds, and they lived out the rest of their lives as a member of the temple flocks. They could engage, you know, in all of the activity that that a goat or a lamb does among other goats and lambs, but they could not be sacrificed to the Lord, right? But because they were dedicated, they could not return to a normal life either. So, at any rate, it would be great if you could read through the last couple of pages of the notes. And if you have any questions about them, you can also always get in touch with me. But I'm going to stop here and see if there are any comments or questions about what we've talked about.
Rabbi?
Yes. What's the difference between a mitzvah? A mitzvah is a commandment. The word mitzvah means commandment. Right? Where is that? Well, I just want to make sure that there isn't a problem with the context. Yeah, where is that? Can anyone help us here? Okay, I don't see it, but yeah, a mitzvah is a commandment, right? Mitzvot is the plural for commandments. It's a synonym for Torah. It's one of the synonyms. It's like commandments, instructions, statutes, judgments, right? It's one of the synonyms. Mitzvah is one of the synonyms used for Torah. Okay? Sure. Anybody else before we go?
I have a question.
Yeah.
It has to do with the story of the...
Yes.
So, early on in the lesson, it talks about priests not being able to defile themselves essentially by a dead person, right? This person was not dead. I mean, he was incapacitated, he wasn't dead. And I was wondering if that prohibition applies to folks that are injured, disabled, sick, or what?
Yeah, it depends on the extent of the injuries. If they're bleeding, then it would fall into the same category.
Oh.
Right? So, yeah, because blood is something that defiles as well. So an individual that is bleeding, and by the way, this would be true even for someone who is not beaten up. If, for example, in my case, I've been injured several times on jobs where I have, where something has happened and I've been cut or bruised and I bleed, right? Well, an issue of blood is something which contaminates, right? So, if that were to occur in biblical times, I would have to be treated immediately, right? I couldn't touch anything, or anyone who touched something I had touched would become unclean too, right? So, yes, so it would apply to an issue of blood or a skin disease which bleeds. I don't know if any of you have ever had poison oak or poison ivy, but you know how the skin bubbles up and oozes a clear fluid, right? That would render someone unclean in biblical times as well, right? Anything that oozes or comes out of the body, right? So it would apply to... I think someone could tell from a distance that the individual had been hurt, right? But of course, in the case of the Sadducees, they believed that their primary responsibility was to God, right? And so they may have had a heart to help that individual, or may have very much wanted to help that individual, but they had to put God and their family first. Right? That was their reasoning. And that, by the way, was not Yeshua's reasoning. Yeshua's reasoning was, by helping him, you serve God. You honor God by helping him. In fact, you honor God more by helping him than what you do at the temple. I mean, it's a great application of the "we are all created in God's image" idea, right? And I can't even imagine how grieved God is at how we treat each other. I can't even imagine it, because it grieves me, right? And I can, what people do to each other is just I don't get it, right? Particularly on the basis of things like skin color or theology or ethnic group. I mean. Anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah. You almost got me started, Ed.
For mitzvah, it's a mitzvah and sentence on page 2.
Oh, okay, great. Let me look at that.
Second column.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
It's on the second page.
Yeah, second column. Under D, about 4:2.
Oh, okay, yes. For the consequence of a mitzvah is a mitzvah. In other words, the consequence of doing a commandment is doing another commandment. In other words, if you do a good deed, you are more likely to do another good deed. And if you sin, once you sin, you are more likely to do another sin than you are to do a good deed. Right? That's the idea.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Ed, I appreciate you finding that. Thank you. Yeah, that's an important important thing to understand.
Bye-bye.
Before you move off the loop one, because I was going to ask a question on that. But so Yeshua was really saying, the point was that even though they were priests and their duties were, they still should have helped. It would have been better if they had helped.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's because his theology was that of the Pharisees. And they believed, the Pharisees taught, that saving a life takes precedence over one's service in the temple. I mean, and, you know, the fact is that the priests, they, you know, I mean, that was their job, that they served in the temple. They served twice a year. It slips my mind, I think probably for a month, but off the top of my head. But they served in the temple for a period of time, right? And then they went home, and they had obviously other responsibilities as well. They had the responsibility to train up their sons to assume their responsibilities when it was time for them to become a priest too, and other responsibilities too. They may have had other responsibilities in the temple. I mean, the temple was the government, effectively. I mean, it was the place where the nation met, you know, for daily services, to celebrate the holidays, for everything, right? So the responsibility that a priest had was great. It not only involved offering sacrifice to the Lord, it involved a lot of things, right? So, you know, so it would be like, you know, what do you do when you can't go to work? You know, do you have the kind of job that your presence is essential? If your presence is essential and you can't be there for one reason or another, you have to get someone to fill in, right? Which can be complicated. So, Yeshua is essentially saying that saving someone's life is more important than whatever it is that you do, even if it involves serving God in the temple, and if they have to find somebody else to fill in for you for the day you're unclean, then so be it. Right? Because you're unclean, depending upon what... You might be unclean for a day, for a week, right? It depends on what the source of the contamination is. But when you're unclean, you cannot serve. You're isolated, right? You're quarantined. Because anything you touch is contaminated. And if someone touches what you touched, then they are contaminated too. Right? So they can't do their job either. Or go home. They can go home, of course, but they can't. You know, you go home, you walk through the door, don't touch anything, to your room, and you stay there for a day or a week or whatever it might be. It's, you know, it was difficult, frankly. But saving a life takes precedence over those things. And by the way, the concept of precedence is very much at the heart of the way the Pharisees understood the Torah, for example. You know, like circumcising your son on the eighth day. What if the eighth day is a Shabbat? What do you do? Do you observe Shabbat and circumcise him on the ninth day? Or do you circumcise him on the eighth day? You circumcise him on the eighth day, right? Is it regarded as a violation of Shabbat? No. Is it a violation of Shabbat? Yes. Of course it is. But it's not regarded as a violation of Shabbat, right? If Yom Kippur is the eighth day, you circumcise your son, right? I mean, that's just the way the system works, according to the Pharisees. So, and that was the way the system worked according to Yeshua as well. His views were the same, right? So,
thank you.
Yeah, the whole, idea of contamination is, some people take it very seriously to this day. You know, those in the Orthodox community take it very seriously. I had a friend when I was living in Palo Alto who happened to be a Cohen, and you know, whenever someone in the congregation passed away, we might talk about that individual, and he might make the point that unfortunately he would not be able to attend the funeral because he was a Cohen, right? So,
can I ask one more question about the following?
Of course.
In previous lessons, we talked about being ceremonially unclean, and there is a process, a ritual to become clean again. Was the defilement of a priest if he touched the dead body, not a direct relative, was that a permanent defilement, or was there a remedy?
Oh, no. No defilement is permanent. None of the defilements are permanent. It depends on what the source of the defilement is. If, for example, you had a relationship with someone who had touched a dead body, for example, right? They would be unclean. If you touched them, you would be unclean. You would be unclean until the evening. You know, when evening came, you would go through the waters of a mikvah, and you would emerge clean. And that's what your friend would do too, right? They would, right, after the period of defilement or uncleanness was over, they would go through the waters of the mikvah in the evening, and they would become clean as well, right? So it was temporary. Sometimes it lasted a day. Sometimes it lasted a week, sometimes it lasted a month. Sometimes it lasted for an indefinite period, like in the case of Tzara'at, which we, you know, refer to as leprosy, but it's a skin disease because, you know, a skin disease, it can last for 2 days, it can last for 2 months, right? But as long as a person has a condition, a skin condition that bleeds or oozes fluid, they would be regarded as unclean. As soon as the oozing or the bleeding stops, right, they go through a mikvah and they're clean. Right, it's all put behind them.
So, Rabbi, that's what happened to the women back in those days?
You mean during a menstrual cycle, for example?
Yeah.
Yes, they were unclean during the period of time they were menstruating. And then after it was over, there's a whole tractate in the section of the Mishnah and in the Talmud that speaks of this. Nida, it speaks of the regulations or the rules regarding, so men and women don't sleep together in an Orthodox Jewish community. Men and women do not sleep together while a woman is menstruating, for example, because she's regarded as unclean. But it's not a moral thing, right? It just has to do with the blood. The uncleanness is not a moral issue at all. I mean, it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with the person morally or ethically, right? It has to do with I can't think of the word off the top of my head. It has to do with being clean, right? When something is clean, there's other words for it. Not sterile, that's too strong a word, but You know, when you clean something, right? When you take Common Cleanser and scrub out your sink, right? I mean, there's nothing, when the sink is dirty, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just dirty. You need to clean it out in order to make sure that, you know, that you kill all the germs, right? Now there is a, it is sometimes said that sara'at is the result of lashon hara, evil speech, right? But an individual who touches a dead body, for example, they're doing a good thing. They might be doing a good thing. They might help prepare that individual for burial, for example. That's regarded as a great mitzvah because the person can't pay you back. Right? You're doing something that makes you unclean, so it costs you something in terms of your relationships with others, and the individual can't pay you back. But you're unclean, but you have done a good thing. You're just unclean because of the contact, right? So it's not a bad thing. Being unclean is not necessarily a bad thing. It can sometimes be regarded as a bad thing, but not generally, right? Generally, it's not good or bad. It's just, you know, it's a way of preventing the spread of disease, you know, being pure, clean. I can't think of the word. It's very frustrating. At any rate, there's a couple of chats. Let me get to them. Marilyn, did that answer your question?
But I was also wondering, did they have to cook during that time since they were unclean?
If they could not cook if they were unclean. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
They couldn't do anything.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. But most things were cleansed at the end of the day. Right? So for example, if you touched a body at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, right? In the middle of winter, your uncleanness would have lasted about 30 minutes. If it was in the middle of summer, it may have lasted for 4 hours, right? At the end of the day, you go through a mikvah and you're clean.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
Rabbi, I was going to ask a question. It's regarding blood and meat, because it says not to eat the blood that's in the meat. Does that defile you also?
Not with kosher meat, because when an animal is slaughtered properly, the blood is drained from the meat, from the body, right? So the blood that is retained, whatever is left over, is not regarded as a problem, right? But what is often done in Orthodox communities, for example, some conservative communities too. When people buy meat from a kosher butcher, meat's red. It's red because of the blood, right? But if it was slaughtered properly, then the blood was drained from the animal before it was cut up. So that blood is not a problem. But what some people do is they salt it, right? With kosher salt. And by the way, kosher salt does not mean that the salt is kosher and can be used in cooking, kosher salt is salt that is used for drawing the blood out of meat. That's what it's for. Right? So, sometimes what people do is before they cook a steak, they will salt it, and then of course they wash the salt off and draw the blood. Have you ever I make a dish with fish, tomatoes, onions, cilantro. Okay? I try to make sure when I cut everything up that everything is very dry. Ceviche, right? I usually make it out of salmon. Salmon ceviche. Okay? So I cut everything up. Everything is very dry. I cut the tomatoes up in a way to make sure that none of the juice from the tomato or the seeds from the tomato gets into the mix. I make a big, big bowl of it, right? The problem becomes when I have to add the salt to it, like garlic salt, for example, to flavor it. Once you add the garlic salt to something like this, those of you who cook have had the same experience. When you add the salt, it draws the liquid out of everything, right? And the ceviche, after a few hours, after a couple of hours, frankly, maybe even less time, is very mushy. There's a lot of juice at the bottom of the bowl, right? Because the salt draws the fluid out of the tomatoes, out of the cilantro, out of the salmon, out of the onions, and it just collects at the bottom, right? So, if I make enough ceviche to last for more than one day, I have to drain that solution off each day, right? That's what salt does with meat. It draws the blood out. And so that's what people sometimes do. They usually salt the meat, draw the blood out. What remaining blood is left in the meat, they draw it out, and then they cook it, right? And whatever blood is left in it is not regarded as defiling. So it's okay to eat meat that has blood in it because all meat has blood in it. You just, you know, it's just impossible to draw it all out.
Thank you, Rabbi. That was very interesting.
So think of it as juice instead. By the way, some of the juice comes from the fat that is left in meat too. And we're not supposed to eat fat either. Right? But, again, with meat there is a certain amount of fat content in the meat. Right? So, from Rivka, aren't all these functions concerning the temple ultimately being filled by the Messiah as he rules and reigns from Jerusalem? Hence the explicit instructions. These instructions are explicit. There's no question about that. They will ultimately be fulfilled in the work of the Messiah. But when the Messiah comes and rebuilds the temple, for example, these principles will once again apply to the high priest and the priesthood that serve at the rebuilt temple. From Susanna, thank you, Rivka, from Susanna. Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Can you explain further how someone in Messiah who does not have physical Jewish ancestry was in the loins of the ancestors? Is this in a spiritual sense? Don't quite understand. Also, some, not all Jews, believe someone who is Jewish and becomes a believer in Yeshua is no longer a Jew. Yet someone who becomes a Buddhist does not. This is sad and unfortunate. Can you explain or give you perspective. Yeah, this is the issue of being in Messiah is one that is not often not well understood. The concept of being in Messiah comes from the idea of being in the loins of someone who performed a particular task. For example, in the book of Hebrews, the author of Hebrews makes a point that because Melchizedek blessed Levi, Melchizedek was greater than Levi, right? The greater blesses the lesser. Does that make sense? So, of course, you say, well, when did Melchizedek bless Levi? Did he? Levi wasn't alive when Melchizedek was around, right? What we do know is that Melchizedek blessed Abraham. Oh, okay, that's nice. So what does that have to do with Levi? Levi was in the loins of Abraham when Melchizedek blessed him. So, the author of Hebrews says, based upon this principle, that Melchizedek blessed Levi. And because Melchizedek blessed Levi, that makes Melchizedek greater than Levi. And because the priesthood of the Messiah is connected to Melchizedek, the priesthood of the Messiah is greater than that of Aaron, who is a descendant of Levi. Does that make sense? The same thing is true in what we just read regarding those of us who are alive today being in the loins of individuals who stood before the Lord when the Torah was given, right? In other words, I was in the loins of my ancestors when they stood before the Lord at Mount Sinai. And so the Torah, according to what we read in Deuteronomy, applies to me in exactly the same way it applies to them. And in the case of the people of Israel, in the case of the Jewish people, we don't have a choice. In the case of the priests, they don't have a choice. A priest is a priest because his father was a priest, not because he aspired to the priesthood, right? A Jew is a Jew because their mother is Jewish, not because they aspire to being Jewish. Although, it is possible to convert to Judaism, right? To become a part of the Jewish people and to be regarded as Jewish. And when someone who's converted to Judaism, when they have children, right, their children are considered Jewish too, by birth, right? So that's the way it works. The passage I read regarding sin is an important one. Even if a Jewish person sins, they're still Jewish, right? Even when a Jewish person turns away or walks away from the Lord, they're still Jewish, right? But today, the Supreme Court of Israel has ruled that a person is considered Jewish as long as they have not converted to another faith. But the only faith that conversion to is a problem with is Christianity, right? For some reason, if a Jewish person becomes Buddhist or converts to Hinduism or Taoism or anything else, it doesn't matter, right? But if a Jewish person converts to Christianity, then they're no longer considered Jewish. But I've had this conversation with many rabbis, and every single one of them have said, if you're Jewish, you're Jewish. Right? That's the way it works. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you do. If you're Jewish, of course, most of them have been Chabad rabbis, and that's just, frankly, the way they are. Right? I mean, because they're their mission is to draw Jewish people closer to the Lord, right? That's what they're all about. So they don't care who you are, where you've been, what you've done, right? None of that makes any difference. Only what you want to do and where you want to go. So legally, at least with regard to the modern state of Israel, if a Jewish person converts to Christianity, then they're no longer considered Jewish. But they can return to Judaism, right, by renouncing Christianity, right? They have to go through a procedure. And, of course, they have to go through a mikvah, right? And they can be restored to Judaism. They're called returnees, right? The process is similar to that of one who goes through a conversion, except that they're referred to as returnees, someone who has turned away from the faith and who has subsequently returned. Okay? They're called returnees. So that's the way it works. The whole issue of being in Messiah is important, in my opinion, because Christians don't think of themselves as being in Messiah. I mean, they think of themselves as being connected to the Messiah, as believing that Yeshua is the Messiah, right? But they don't think about the ramifications of being in the Messiah, right? But of course, those ramifications, in my view, are taught very clearly in the apostolic literature, like when Paul talks about the olive tree, for example, and he talks about the wild branches being grafted into the olive tree among the natural branches, right? I mean, Gentiles who trust Yeshua as the Messiah, they are grafted in to Israel. They become a part of Israel, which is exactly what Paul says in his letter to the Ephesians too, right? Paul says, at one time you were strangers from the promises that God made with his people, the covenants that God made with his people. But in the Messiah, you are connected to these things, right? So, is there a difference in thinking that you are a part of God's people, Israel? Is there a difference between that and thinking that you are a part of a church that God raised up to replace Israel? Is there a difference between those two things? In my opinion, there's a big difference between those two things. And not only is there a big difference between, you know, understanding the scripture in that way, there is a big difference in terms of you know, what you do, how you worship God, what things are important to you and what things are not, right? I mean, if you are in the Messiah, which Paul says, then you become a part of him. But he's a part of Israel. He's Jewish. He's a descendant of David, right? He's a member of one of Israel's 12 tribes. So that connects you to the tribes as well. It obviously doesn't make you Jewish, right? But it does make you a part of God's people. And, you know, if you are grafted into the olive tree, I mean, I get my nourishment from the sap of the olive tree. Where do you get yours? From the sap of the olive tree. Is there any difference between what you get and what I get? Frankly, there is horticultural evidence to suggest, and I've done this with, I've researched this, that an olive tree gives its best to the grafted in branches. Right? It goes out of its way to give its best to the grafted in branches. which means that the grafted in branches, you know, there is a desire for them to be there, right? These concepts are not confusing to me in any way. I just don't really understand how they can be so confusing to others, right? Gentiles who embrace Yeshua as the Messiah are connected to the covenants and promises that God made with Israel. Jews who embrace Yeshua as the Messiah are not connected to a church. Right? The church doesn't exist in the Bible, in the apostolic literature. It doesn't exist for 100 years after Yeshua comes. Right? I mean, it's difficult. Because today, of course, people think of these things very differently than they did in the first century. Right? Today, Christians are a part of a church. The church is an institution God raised up, or a people that God raised up to replace Israel. So anything having to do with Israel is, you know, is regarded as unimportant, you know, not valuable, inconsequential, right? I mean, what difference does it make whether Jews circumcise their sons on the eighth day or not? What does that have to do with me, right? What difference does it make when Passover is celebrated, or Shavuot, or Sukkot, or any of the other holidays? What difference does it make? Should I be celebrating them? I'm not a part of Israel. I trust that Jesus is the Messiah. But Christians tend not to really think of themselves as being in the Messiah, in the way it's described biblically. Right? If the condition wasn't profound, then the author of Hebrews would have nothing to say about the relative value of the priesthood of Melchizedek over that of Aaron, right? And the priesthood of Aaron is good. It's just that the priesthood of Melchizedek is gooder, right? If you're concerned about the Olam Haba. If you're not, it doesn't matter. Right? Anyway, I hope that answered the question. From Rivka, concerning female purity practices today, it's on Chabad.org in the female section. I practice it myself when relevant before menopause. It is a ritual mitzvah. I meant a nice ritual mitzvah, lots of laughs. So there is a good deal of information if you're interested on Chabad.org. There is a section. You can go to Chabad.org, for example, and you can type in the word female purity, and a section will come up that addresses these issues. But once a woman reaches menopause, then these instructions don't apply. From Kaylee, I am down to 5% power, so if I am all of a sudden gone, I want to thank you for a great study this week in Shavuot Tov. Thank you. I guess, yep, Kaylee's gone, so... Thank you, Kaylee. From Beth Ann, if a woman converts to Judaism, would their children that are living become Jewish? No. Not unless they're infants. But their young children would have to go through the process as well. It's just simpler. It's simpler for them. But they would have to go through a process and go through the mikvah as well. From Susanna, is it fair to say that if Christianity really understood what it means to be in the Messiah grafted in, they would be following the Torah, observing Shabbat? they would certainly be doing, they would certainly regard the Torah as important and meaningful and not as irrelevant. Right? And they would be taught how to apply Torah principles to their lives, as opposed to being taught that the Messiah fulfilled the Torah and it is therefore no longer relevant for us. Right? So, yeah, so I think that, you know, things like what is and isn't food would apply more broadly. What day the Sabbath is, Saturday, not Sunday, you know, when to celebrate holidays, what holidays to celebrate. I mean, let me put it a different way. When the Messiah comes, all the nations on the planet will observe the Torah. Right? So what does that mean? I mean, think about it. In Zechariah, it is specifically said that the nation that does not send representatives to Jerusalem to celebrate Sukkot will be punished. Right? Which means, by definition, that they have an obligation to celebrate Sukkot. But this isn't a reference to Israel. This is a reference to the other nations. All nations will celebrate Sukkot during the millennium. And Passover, too. Yeshua said, when he celebrated Passover with his disciples, right? I'm not going to celebrate this again until I celebrate it anew with you in the kingdom, right? But Passover is the first holiday. Sukkot is the last holiday, which is a Hebrew way of saying, and everything in between, right? I am the Alpha and the Omega, or the Aleph and the Tav. Does that mean he's the Gimel and the Mem as well? He doesn't say he is. He says, I'm the Aleph and the Tav. I'm the first and last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. What about the middle 20 letters? Is he those letters too? Of course he is. So, the fact is that the Torah isn't going away anytime soon. And when the Messiah comes, the law of the Lord will cover the earth as water covers the sea. I don't know how you can say it covers it more completely than that. Right? It will cover every nation, all lands, all languages, all people, regardless of their ethnic identity, regardless of the color of their skin. None of those things will have any relevance whatsoever when the Messiah comes. Wouldn't it be nice if it didn't have any relevance now? Wouldn't it? Anyway, you know, I could go on and on. Anybody else have a comment? Ed, your screen is lit up, but I don't hear you.
Oh, no. Sorry. I was
there you go.
I had a frog in my throat. My evil lesson and the discussion. It's wonderful as usual.
Thank you. I appreciate it. The discussion, the discussions, of course, you have a lot to do with, too. So I always appreciate that. Very good. Thank you, Ed. Anybody else before we go? Thank you for the chats, the comments, observations, questions. Anybody else before we go? Regarding the question, Beth Ann, that you asked, I don't know. There may be differences in different communities. I don't know at what age children are considered a part of the person who converts. I'm not sure at what age they have to be before they're required to go through the process on their own. They would have to be pretty young, I think. But at any rate, From Beth Ann, great study and discussion. Thank you. And everyone?
Thank you.
Thank you, Beth Ann. Anybody else before we go? Okay. Well, then I'll say Shavua Tov. Oh, there's Joseph's face. Good to see you, Joseph. Very good. Okay, you guys. One last thing. This Thursday, we're starting our seminar on understanding the significance of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Okay? Thursday night at 7:30 Central Daylight Time. 7:30 Central Daylight Time. So it's called the Qumran Library, Understanding the Significance of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It should be an incredibly fascinating study. The table of contents and the first chapter will be available. They probably are already available on the website, right? And so, I'm just working on a few details on the last chapter, so it'll be ready very soon for distribution. Okay, so with that, I'll say Shavuot Tov. Have a great week. Hopefully, I'll see you during the week on Wednesday or Thursday. May the Lord be with you. God bless you guys.
Thanks, Rabbi.
God bless everyone. Lila Toe, God bless you. Thank you.
Looking forward to the study, Rabbi.
Thank you. Me too. Goodbye for now.